Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. My name is Nate Klarfeld, and this is Stonewall Live, the best of book, film, and media talk on Blog Talk Radio. Tonight, I have Chris Glosser, an LGBT theologian who has written 12 books. Some of them, their titles are As My Own Soul, The Blessing of Same-Gender Marriage, Coming Out to God, The Word is Out, Daily Reflections on Bible for Lesbians and Gay Men, and most recently, a book called The Final Destination. The Final Deadline, What Death Has Taught Me About Life. Before I get started, I want to mention a personal note. I read all the books of all my author interviews, and I read The Final Deadline last week, and it's a very quick read. I want you to say a couple, 3 hours, and you'll be done. After reading the book, I had this profound feeling of uplifting awareness, and the word that kept coming into my heart was clarity. So I want to introduce Chris, and I want to ask him if that's happened to other people. Go ahead, Chris. Welcome.
Thanks, Nate. Thanks for having me on your program. The people who've talked to me who've read the book say that, first of all, they get in touch with their own feelings about the deaths that they've experienced in their lives. But then they found comfort somehow in hearing me relate the stories of death in my life. And I have to say that I myself came to a place of clarity as I was writing the book. I mean, that was the whole reason for writing the book. Writers write about things that they are concerned about. And so that's what happened to me as I was writing the book. That was, I kept thinking, why am I writing this book?
Yeah.
It came to me that it was to come to some place of peace and to understand the meaning of these lives in my life and the meaning of these deaths in my life. Mm-hmm. So thank you. I appreciate your saying that.
Okay, you've written 12 books. You look like you're about 18, 20 years old in your picture. how did you start writing? Give us a little insight into how did you start writing.
Well, writing came to me because, you know, being a gay boy growing up in an anti-gay world in the 50s, writing was a way of taking control, taking charge of my life. And words were very important to my parents. They read a lot. They wrote. And right now I'm working on a book of letters that they exchanged during three periods of circumstantial separation. And And they were really great writers, especially my father. He's a big storyteller. And so I found that words were a way of finding meaning, discovering what my life meant to me. And so that's how I became a writer. And so all my books deal with various subjects that were near and dear to me, and I hopefully near and dear to the readers' hearts as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let me go into a part in the book. In one of the books, you have more friends than Jessica Fletcher. You have more dead friends than Jessica Fletcher. That's one of the quotes of one of your good friends. And at one of your experiences with death, you're at a murder scene of a friend, and then you start lingering there, absorbing the fact that something profound happened here. Does death leave an energy in the room?
Well, I think there was an energy in that room. Part of it is an energy of memory. I was remembering what had happened in that room, and I described the scene, which is a very messy scene. I mean, the detective shows, the crime shows, the forensic shows on television don't really capture how messy death is,
right?
And especially after the police come in and fingerprint everything. It was a mess, and the residue was still, there. And so I realized that something very profound had happened there. Somebody had met their end there in a violent way. And I think that the reason people experience ghosts, particularly in places where people whose lives have been violently taken, is that there's something unresolved there in our own psyches, perhaps, but maybe even in the space. I don't know. I felt that there was a presence there. It's like when you go into a temple where they sacrificed animals or sometimes people, you recognize that there was something going on there that was deeper than what we normally experience. And that's what I experienced in that room as I was in the room of a place where someone had been murdered.
Okay, good. I'm going to ask a question not off the book, but back into your experience being a minister to gay men and women. How does a gay man or woman who's been rejected by his and her home religion, sometimes pretty nastily, find faith again?
Well, that's it's tough to do that. I think what happens for most of us is that we find faith in ourselves and in those closest to us, those who love us, our lovers, our partners, our friends, family members who are accepting and welcoming, and sometimes that includes spiritual communities that welcome us. And so I think that we're stronger, perhaps, even in the face of death than our dominant culture counterparts, because we've had to have hidden strength to survive. This recent campaign, It Gets Better, to young LGBT people is really important because it does get better, but not because the taunting gets less necessarily, but because we get stronger.
Right.
And so I think that gay men, lesbians, and bisexual and transgender people are much stronger in the face of adverse conditions than I necessarily think of the broader population in terms of my ministry anyway.
So
it's faith in ourselves, and then two, we are able to discern, the better roots of our spiritual traditions, whatever they are, Jewish, Christian, Buddhist, etc. And we take from those roots strength in the face of many of our colleagues in our spiritual communities who may not be as accepting or welcoming, or may be more judgmental. So we take the positive attributes of our spiritualities into our experience of adversity.
Right. I have another question going back to the book, but I have to go ahead and do a little commercial here. If you're on the show page for Chris Glosser's interview tonight, you'll see a picture of his book, The Final Deadline, What Death Has Taught Me About Life. If you click on that, you'll be taken directly to Amazon.com's website where you can buy the book and all the other books by Chris. They're all linked right there. That's number one. Number two, our call-in number tonight to ask questions or make a comment for Chris is 805-830-8355. I now give that out as my home number because I've said it so many times. But yeah, so okay, I've finished with my commercials. I can go on to my next question about the book. I'm going to give you another quote from the book that I felt was very moving, and I wrote it down and put it on a 3x5 card. It's now sitting on my wall, so I'll read it. Death has taught me discipline. Death has taught me to take risks. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, the fact of the matter is that we only have so much time, and as much as our spiritual traditions may try to elongate that time by, promising eternal existence or reincarnation or what have you, we know that we have this amount of time till our death, and that this time is meaningful and sacred, and that we have to regard it and guard it well. And so the discipline is just in terms of, as a writer, a deadline to me is helpful because I know when I have to get something done. I know when I have to, and as an editor, when I have to put a magazine to bed, when I have to, finish some project or an article. And so death is that kind of a reminder that we have to get it done, whatever it is. Whether it's some vocation that we wish we had tried, or something like from the bucket list, some experience that we wanted to have. And so that's the discipline. And people, unfortunately, because of the educational system, discipline and our whole system of justice, et cetera. Discipline is about is a negative thing. But I see discipline like, you know, and discipline of art, discipline of learning to play tennis, that's what life is about. It's a discipline to learn how to do something that you want to do and to take the time to do it, to take the time to learn the skill, and then to take the time. One of the deaths I talk about in the book is Tommy Thompson, who was a New York Times bestselling author, and he really taught me that discipline was what differentiated the would-be writer from the actual writer. You know, setting aside a certain amount of time a day to write and doing that no matter what. And I think I describe in the book, I'm not sure, but a friend of mine who wrote what he called 10-minute stories, I said, you don't write a story in 10 minutes. He said, no, but I have to be at that typewriter 10 minutes after I get home from work. You know, the plants could be screaming for water, but I'm going to be at that typewriter, and I write. And he had written like 40 stories in a couple-year period with that method. So discipline is a good thing. It's a way of accomplishing what we find fulfilling. Something else I make clear in the book is that it's not simply about pleasure. It's about fulfillment and doing something that's meaningful for us.
Anyway, we have a question from the chat room. You know, we have an interactive chat room. People who don't want to call in for any anonymous reason, so I'll ask that question. The question is, we're all about the same age. I think death and all its A's related because that's my experience. How can I have a broader view of death as a gay man? In other words, broadening it from the AIDS experience.
Well, I think that I'm a little puzzled by the question. I guess how can I have a broader experience of death? We are of the same age. We came from the period when AIDS was so prevalent as the killer of our people. But the fact of the matter is that we've also had experience other deaths that were not AIDS related, and so that we automatically usually have a broader experience of death than AIDS. And it's easy to get focused on AIDS. I mean, it's necessary in some ways, but we have to, we know that there's all kinds of death. And so I think what I've experienced personally, what set in context what I call the death by plague in my chapter on AIDS, is that there were other plagues. There were other, dark periods in human history when people died from, you know, the plague. But I also use the example of the virus of anti-Semitism that killed so many Jews at the hands of Nazis. I think that there are all kinds of calamitous experiences that we can look at historically to find meaning for our own death. So another example I use in that chapter is the Hiroshima survivors, those who survived the bombing, atomic bombing of Hiroshima. And I have, you know, mixed feelings about the atomic bombs because my dad was saved from combat duty and was part of the occupying forces in Japan because of the atomic bombs, so it saved my dad's life in many ways. Yeah, but at the same time, that devastation was so like what we experienced in the initial decade of the AIDS crisis, or initial decades, I should say, of the AIDS crisis. And what's really sad is that now peoples around the world are experiencing what we experienced in the 80s. They're experiencing for the first time in, you know, the 2010 and 11. So we have to be mindful that the AIDS crisis isn't over, that it's still going on in our community, but also throughout the world. Correct. And so I think linking that to other experiences and seeing how other people experience those kinds of Holocausts. I also quote from Albert Camus' book, The Plague, where he writes about the experience of plague. And I so identified with the narrator in that book who really wants to heal people. And I think many of us were called to be healers and have been called to be healers in the AIDS crisis here in the United States.
Good. I'm going to go back to another quote in the book that I enjoyed, and I want you to comment on that. Could you describe the quote, eating the carrots, from the time Snoopy had his love affair with the snowman? I love that story.
Yeah, for some reason that cartoon stuck with me. It's a very funny thing. Linus and Charlie Brown are watching Snoopy outside with a snowman, and who has a carrot nose and, you know, little coal eyes and a hat and a scarf and sticks for arms. And Snoopy is resisting friendship with the snowman because he knows that the sun will come out and the snowman will leave him. And so he resists and resists, but Snoopy is so lovable, he just can't resist. And so he throws his arms around the snowman and says, you know, says, okay, I'm going to love you. I mean, he doesn't actually say that, but that's the implication. And then the sun comes out and starts to melt snowman. And Snoopy's ears go out to the side. He's like, ah, this big og sound that is typical of the Peanuts cartoons. And Charlie Brown, Linus turns to Charlie Brown, or I forget which it was. I guess it was Linus turned to Charlie Brown and said, oh, poor Snoopy, he's so sensitive. And Charlie Brown says, yeah, but he's not too sensitive to eat the carrot. Meaning the snowman melted, he took the carrot and ate it.
Right.
And that's what I describe doing, actually, with all these deaths, is that there's a carrot here. There's something nutritional in all of this. This sounds really gruesome when you talk about death, but
right.
There's something to help you grow in the if you take time to digest it. Take it in and see how it touches your heart.
Right.
I really believe in what Thomas More writes in Care of the Soul, where he believes everything that happens to us shapes our soul, and I believe good and bad shape our soul. And mostly we're willing to say, be grateful for the good things, but not the bad things. But the bad things also shape our souls and shape us into the people we are.
Right. It's like I guess, I think it's Kabbalah that says, embrace your garbage. You know, it's part of your life. You know, it's part of the thing.
Absolutely.
There's a reason why it comes at you, that there's good in even evil and there's good in even bad things. Okay, staying on the dog theme, one of the most moving chapters in the book was the loss of your dog, the death of your dog. It was very, very emotional. I could tell that was probably one of the big losses in there. There were many, of course, with your parents and your friends and the violence. But to talk about the loss of your dog.
Well, you know, I think that the loss of a pet is particularly devastating, because when you're working with a human being that knows what death is, it's a little different than when you're working with a pet who has no idea. And it's like the pets are the totally innocent creatures in our lives. I mean, because they don't know what death is, and you know what it is, and you know what's coming. And I had to euthanize because he was in such bad shape. He was in such pain. And that was just a terrible decision to have to make.
Uh-huh.
And the veterinarian came to the house and put him asleep there. And so at least he was able to die in his own home. And after he was gone, I just threw myself on him and wailed. And because he was really the longest relationship I had to myself for 13 years, you know, we were close and slept in the same bed and that sort of thing, because he would get up on the bed and especially saw me through some difficult times, my mother's death and my breakup of what I had hoped would be a lifelong relationship that I describe in that same chapter. And so he had seen me through some rough times. And I really believe that animals do show compassion, and that so Calvin was his name, and we also had this intimate connection because we had written a book together. He had written a book called The Wit and Wisdom of Calvin the Dog, and we had gone up to the Chicago Book Expo to publicize the book, and he did a paw signing, potographing
at
the same table that Charlton Heston had just gotten up from where he was signing his autobiography.
Really? That's funny. Because I've been to a Rita Mae Brown signing, and she brings the cat.
Wonderful.
I don't know if it's the same cat, because this cat must be 80 years old, because she's been writing since, you know, there's 50 Sneaky, I think it's Sneaky Pete.
Rita Mae Brown, she is so, I mean, I don't know personally, but I love her writing, so.
I do too.
Yeah, I get to see her. Bringing her cat.
Yeah, she brings her cat everywhere. And as far as a dog goes, we've had Greg Louganis at the library, and he always travels with his dogs. His dogs have never written a book. His dogs have only he's wrote a book, but his book I think was a little ghost written, because I won't talk about that. All right.
I met the ghostwriter actually when Greg Louganis was here in Atlanta. Did a book signing at Outright, and so I actually there was a big long line to meet Greg Louganis, and I wanted to meet his co-writer. Yeah, it wasn't really a ghostwriter. He was up front with the writing it with this guy, and
he was very upfront. He's very upfront about it.
Yeah.
And he explains why. He does explain why. I mean, we're getting off Chris Glosser here, but he sacrificed his education for diving.
He didn't
have the luxury that, and he's doing it now. He's actually getting very educated now. We're not going to talk about that anymore. I'm going to move away from the book, because you have got an incredible curriculum vitae. You created the curricula, the online curricula for the Human Rights Campaign, the HRC's curricula for the movie For the Bible Tells Me So, and I'm from St. Louis, and my mother, actually, one of my first memories of life, being about 5 or 6 years old, is my mother schlepping me to work the polls or work the campaign line for Dick Gephardt. I'm from St. Louis.
He
was my congressman for, I don't know, a bazillion years growing up. At first he was a state representative, then a U.S. congressman. So tell us about the book, the movie The Bible Tells Me So, and this HRC curricula, because I don't think many of our listeners know much about that.
Well, and let me just say to you that my parents hailed from Kansas and Missouri, so we have connections there. The curriculum is available free on the website of HRC. It's kind of hard to find, but you click on issues and then go to Faith and Religion program, I think it's called, or Religion and Faith program. But it was Harry Knox who was the director there of that program, who's now gone on to serve at MCC in Houston, who told me about doing this. It was a great opportunity. I love doing it. I worked with Sharon Groves at HRC, and she was a great person to work with, and I loved working with them. And so what the curricula is really a more than you need to know about all the background issues of the movie. And what I did was I actually went to I did several focus groups. We watched the movie together, and I said, and then I asked them what they would like to talk about now. And as much as those of us who might be seminary trained might want to talk about the biblical issues, or so they wanted to talk about the family issues, because the families represented there were so different in how they approached their gay or lesbian children and their faith. And so that's where we started, and that's where the curricula starts. And then it goes on into looking more deeply at the scriptures that are talked about in the movie. The movie is incredible.
I love it. Yeah.
Incredibly well done, well edited piece that deals with all the issues. And for this day and age, it can do more than a book can do in terms of communicating what needs to be communicated about religion and homosexuality. So I would highly recommend it to your listeners. but also the that curriculum is available for anybody. We were thinking of doing a personal tutorial for it, but we didn't have the resources to do that. So, but it is available online for anybody who wants to take a look at it and get more details about some of the issues that are raised up in that movie.
They can
also use groups and congregations as well.
Right, right. And Dick Gephardt and his family are on the cover. That's why I brought up Cindy Gephardt.
And they're one of the families that are depicted in the film. And he's just an outstanding person.
Isn't he just amazing? That man should have been president. He should have been
the
president.
The way he stood by his daughter and, you know, he didn't care how it affected his career.
Right.
Boy, you don't meet many politicians like that today.
No, not at all. Not at all. You do hundreds of retreats and speeches throughout your career. And do you have any that you're, I'm going to talk about your website and your blog here because we're down into the last 3 minutes of the show. Do you believe this flew by in 30 minutes? Like, boom. First of all, what's your next retreat you're doing? Are you doing one soon?
Let me think a minute.
Okay. While you're thinking, I'll talk about your website and your blog. Okay.
Go ahead,
you
do
just
that.
Think. Okay. It's chrisglosser.com, but it's spelled chrisglaser, just like his name is spelled with no spaces. .com, and on there you'll have a link to his blog. He's now going to be blogging because everyone blogs, and that's it's part of our lives right now. That's how we're building our network. We're building a new community. We're building an electronic, beautiful community. And I just wanted to ask, I didn't want to put you on the spot. I should have had you at a pre-chat about this, but I just noticed you do so many GLBT retreats and wonderful things, and I just wondered if you're doing anything recent so we can tell our listeners about it. But put it on your website, put it on your blog.
It'll be on the website, and I've been doing a lot of spirituality kinds of workshops and seminars because that's my larger issue. But also, I've been because of my previous book, As My Own Soul, Blessing of Same Gender Marriage. I've been doing workshops on deconstructing and reconstructing marriage. People would be amazed if they really knew the history of marriage, and there are a lot of books that try to do that, and I certainly did that in the book. The blog is going to be different from typical blogs in that it's going to really try to encourage people who want to embrace a progressive spirituality, specifically progressive Christianity, but you know, I draw on Buddhist and Hindu and all kinds of spiritualities in my own spirituality. So that's definitely is going to appear, but it's not going to be something that's political necessarily.
We're at 1 minute, and I get to ask my 1 minute question. Okay, here it is.
Sure,
this is our last question. If you could have 5 minutes with the Pope, what would you say to him?
Girl, what are you thinking? and he would probably ask me, what can God be thinking? But that's, I would just say, hey, with one word, you could change the whole view of the church.
With one word.
So with one word, you can say, gay is okay.
Right, right. And I'm, or I'm wearing Prada shoes, do the math. That's what
who do you think designed those robes?
That's right. I don't want to get into that, but really, you're saying that the man has incredible power.
Oh, he does. He does, and rightly so. I mean, there's so many things he speaks in ways that touch me.
Right.
It's in this area, he kind of has this blind spot, but that's something that could be changed. That's one of the things
that's.
Reality is we believe in transformation.
I believe that too. I mean, look at what's happened even in the Orthodox community with 60 Orthodox rabbis signing a letter saying that we're not going to try to change anybody anymore. We're not going to tell them to get married, and we're going to study this. So I think it's in different directions. Yeah. Real quick shout out. You were with the founding director of the Lazarus Project, which was a dialogue. And I had lunch with Brian McNaught today, and he says hello.
oh, hello back to Brian. He was one of our speakers, and then
right.
I saw him again here in Atlanta.
Yeah, he made sure.
For a while.
He made sure. I said, anyway, we're done. And I want to thank you a gazillion times for this. This will be on, if to tell your friends that missed this, this will be on the Blog Talk Radio for 5 years. And so good night, all. Take care.
Good night, Nate.
Bye-bye.